What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Mongols River Hounds podcast. I'm Mike. With me, as always, is Kev and Josh. Coming up on today's show, we'll talk about some news around the USL, we'll recap the Hounds' most recent game against Charlotte, and we'll preview two of the last three games of the season. Let's go!
Can you believe that, guys?
No, I mean, that is the craziest sequence of events we've seen in quite a period of time.
In the top right corner, gentlemen. Out to the middle, back to
So I feel like, you know, as we get closer to the end of the season here, we should do almost like a behind the scenes kind of show, because I always feel weird. What people probably don't realize is that the music that you just heard, I'm the only one that can hear that while we're recording. So I'm sitting here and I'm sort of like bobbing along, and Josh and Kevin are probably just staring at me like, come on, man.
It's always longer than I think it is. Like, it starts going, I'm like, okay, all right. It's still going? Like, one of these times, I'm swearing, like, he's not even listening to music now. He's just sitting here as long as possible, see how long we'll just watch him bob his head.
I just look away. I'm like, I'm not going to look at this.
Just wait till Mike starts talking. Yeah. I need to get, like, a soundboard or something, or figure out how that works.
That'd be cool.
We'll get there. Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned in the opening, yes, we know the Hounds lost. We're going to talk about that. But there's some other stuff that's going around the USL as the season wraps up, and we figured that it might be interesting.
Let's talk about anything else other than the River Hounds lost. Let's do that.
Mince words about it. Really, just us not wanting to talk about the Hounds lost.
It may be a very short show. We'll see. The first bit of news that came out this week was that New York Red Bulls 2 actually locked up the top position in the league. They're on 63 points with two games left to play. And to me, I was like, well, that's a little bit odd, because, you know, we always hear all this buzz about these teams out west, like Sacramento, and you know, how they're so much better. And when I dug into it and you look at the standings, I think that it may be the case that the West actually is better, and that the Red Bulls just really benefited from playing in the East. Because if you look at it, the East currently has five teams with less than 30 points, Hounds being one of them. The West only has one. So that sort of tells me, you know, the Hounds and everybody in the East really only play everybody else in the East, and the West only plays against the West. So the range of points per team is a lot wider in the East, which tells me that you have some really good teams and then some really poor teams that just got beat up on, whereas in the West it seems like it's a little bit more even. You know, kudos to Red Bulls too. Kev, we're just gonna wind you up. What are your thoughts on a B team being the number one team in the USL?
Yeah. I mean, everything I feel about this, I think I've already said in previous podcasts. I'll try to reiterate in a more spicy manner here. I mean, no communities get built around B teams. Like, no father son remembers the time out they went to go see the B team. I mean, that's. I have a very negative feeling on B teams in the USL. I get the attraction of it, especially for, you know, bigger clubs like the Red Bulls. Obviously, it seems like it's paying dividends to them. Although I would be curious to look into their whole setup a bit more. I mean, is this actually benefiting them? Are they seeing progression of young players in their quote unquote academy? And, you know, are they getting shots in the first team? I don't know. I'm not trying to suggest one or the other. Josh, don't I?
Yeah, I actually do think, as far as the one-sidedness of the relationship goes, as far as MLS benefiting from it, I think they do. Because I remember what the Reserve League was like for MLS before they were integrated into USL. The Reserve League was a joke. They originally had their own league where it was just all the B teams playing each other, but the schedules were all crazy. It was just like, we'll go 4 weeks without playing a game, then we'll have one game.
But that's my big gripe about it, is like, if it's a joke, then like the clubs need to put it upon themselves to just take it more seriously. Don't bring that like stuff into a lower league side that already has team set up on themselves.
I think the reason why they couldn't, though, is because they didn't really have infrastructure to have a scheduling-based system going. Like, it was just hard to manage for all these, you know, reserve teams to, like, it was up on the coaches, I think, to, like, come up with a schedule. It's like, no, that's not going to work. Like, with USL, bringing them into the USL, now there's a structure, there's a, you know, a whole front office of the league working on making sure it's balanced enough for them. And I'm not saying it's great for USL,
right?
Because I think that's a whole different conversation. But as far as if it's beneficial to the or MLS, I definitely think it is. And plus, you get them playing teams that do care a lot more by having, like, the Riverhounds and Charlotte and, like, all those teams that aren't B teams coming in.
No, I get all those arguments. My only counter, I mean, look, and I'm biased. I'm coming from the perspective of the USL thing. And I don't know. It's like, look, MLS, just hire, like, another intern. Or just, like, I'm not saying, like, just hire one other person and say, okay, look, your job is to sort out MLS Reserve League. And just tell the clubs, look, like, this is up to you to take this seriously. And I know that, you know, in England, it's kind of an issue where there is a reserve, like, under 23 league, and no one takes it seriously. And everyone's thinking, like, oh, let's kind of push them down to League One. And it was like, no, don't come and encroach on our kind of pre-built league where we have these community and all this other. And so, yeah, I get what you're saying. And I think, yeah, it would make sense that it is not only easier for the MLS, but also increases their talent pool. But I think it's too much at the detriment of the USL. And I actually think if you start looking at the USL as a legitimate, I don't know, builder of American soccer.
Like a developmental league.
Yeah, almost. I mean, if you start looking at it as a legitimate part of the U.S. soccer system, then, you know, it could actually be treated as such and start to get, you know, integrated in such a way that it's healthy for everything. But just treating it like this is, I don't think it's that route.
I think it's the baby steps, though. I think it's going to have some growing pains. I can see it working. Like, I can see stuff like Bethlehem Steel, where it's technically a B team. I mean, Bethlehem Steel is supposed to be Philly. So it's rebranded itself to be its own entity. It feels like its own club. It doesn't feel like it is just a B team. Mm-hmm. I wish we would see other clubs do that, where they move them away from, they're not playing in the same stadium as the MLS team, have their own stadium, have their own atmosphere, have their own everything. And then, you know, in the front office, you know, it's a B team, but it's not like, it doesn't feel like a B team.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, if you can have something where, yeah, like, a community of fans can get around it and solely support that kind of club unto itself with the knowledge that there maybe is this higher club, then I would be much more willing to, I don't know, stomach that. But
we had traveling fans
from
Bethlehem Steel come to a Riverhounds game, or, like, you know, when we played them at Highmark, they traveled there, and there was, like, you know, only like about 10 of them, but still, that's a traveling fan base.
Absolutely.
And you wouldn't see that with Red Bulls too, unless it's just like the family members of the team members.
Yeah.
But with Bethlehem Steel, you see that because they actually do have their own entity and their own just feel to them. They're not just Philly too.
I think we just sorted this. I think.
Yeah, well, there you go. You are welcome, USL front office.
Yeah, I think that the only way that the B team idea is really going to stick is if you start moving into markets that don't have soccer teams, and so then therefore it's just like what you guys said. And I believe that the Red Bulls put out a press release where there is movement to get New York Red Bulls to their own stadium, so they're not playing in Red Bull Arena in Harrison, and they're not playing, like, right before the Red Bulls game. Because right now, if you have both of those teams playing in the same stadium, there's very little incentive for people to go see Red Bulls too.
I think sometimes they play, or I forget what team was, so they would play in the practice field of the MLS team. That's even worse. Like, not only are you a B team at that time, but you're also playing in a place that doesn't support stadium atmosphere.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing about this to me was when I saw this, and we've known for a while that New York Red Bulls 2 is a good team, my immediate thought was, well, okay, they have the money and they have the backing of the MLS team, and that's why they're able to do so good. And then I started to think about it more, and I'm like, well, it seems that Red Bull sort of have this consistent system, and so they have, I can't remember if they have an actual high school in the same way that Los Angeles Galaxy now have a high school, but they do have a massive youth program where they're pulling from multiple areas in, you know, Jersey, New York, even parts of Eastern PA to try to fill this pool. And they put these kids through this whole system that then go on, and they're typically some of the top college recruits, and they end up going and playing through the USL. And I'm like, okay, well, that's a lot of that is thanks to the MLS, but really not necessarily. It's just sort of the way the system is. We have a youth system. We have like this feeder program for the Hounds, but there's never really, I mean, there's one or two players that we may see every year that sort of work their way up.
It's still pretty young, though. I mean, like, I don't know what the ages are as far as how much have we had people who've gone from kids from, you know, very, very young all the way up to playing with the Hounds Academy till they're out of high school. I don't know if we've only had people coming in, you know, hey, they joined while they're in high school and then
right.
they, you know, had a shot. But I would be interested to know when we actually get that progression going.
Yeah, and like going back to the Red Bulls thing, like, I mean, I think that infrastructure that they're putting into place is great, and I can understand if all the MLS clubs don't have the resources to kind of set that up themselves. But I don't know, maybe think I would be more willing to kind of host the idea of having MLS teams who have this infrastructure in place put a B team in the USL if there was a bit more transparent direction from both the MLS and USL and say, look, this is our 5 to 10 year plan. In the short term, this is what we're going to do. In the long term, we don't see this being the case of having B teams in the USL. We're just going to kind of provide this latency period to have the entire MLS kind of catch up to this. And this is going to be something that we, you know, mandate, and we think it's important to have these kind of, you know, strong supportive structures around youth academies in each of these MLS clubs. And then after everyone kind of catches up with that, then we can move on to this, I don't know, bigger idea that I think works. But to my knowledge, there isn't much of a direction in that sense. And I'll probably wrong, and someone on Twitter will correct me. But
I mean, part of the MLS structure is you have to have an academy. So every team does have an academy, but just how strong is that academy, right. How well supported it is. Question, would you be satisfied if Red Bulls 2 changed their name to the Pink Cows?
I mean, it would make me laugh more, that's for sure.
All right, okay. That's where all I have to do. Change the name.
Where would the Pink Cows be based?
I would say New Jersey, but never mind. That's where Red Bulls play.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think that, yeah, I agree with everything that you guys said. I guess more or less, you know, I was thinking of it as like, oh, okay, you know, Red Bulls 2 really benefit because they're part of this bigger system, and that's why they're able to be top in the USL. But really, I don't think that's the case. I think it's sort of that top to bottom structure of, you know, youth all the way up through one consistent system so you can plug and play and move forward. And we've talked about stability a lot so far this season, and having a new coach and now having a new system and all of that. You know, I think having a few years of stability are really going to benefit the Hounds, which sort of leads to the next point. That I put out here, our buddy Sean McPherson, who we've had on the show a few times, he recently moved to Atlanta, so that's why he's no longer writing for Pen 97 or joining us to talk about City Islanders. He tweeted out some exciting news for the Orange County Blues FC. That's not OCB. It's actually Orange County Blues FC, and they're in the Western Conference. They have new owners, and he mentioned that, you know, he's excited to see. There's a whole article that the USL put out about rebranding, new stadium, etc., all this stuff on the way, where Orange County, you know, they're a team that's there, but they were sort of floundering. And we've seen this, we saw this with Rochester last year, where Rochester was the top team in the league, and they were still sort of floundering financially, and, you know, they had issues with their stadium, and the USL went out and got new ownership, and you know, ownership with deep pockets to sort of help. With, you know, they got a new logo, they got the waterlogged turf replaced. I only see this as something interesting because we've talked a lot on the show about how, not necessarily this is a rebuilding year, but obviously we are extremely grateful for everything that's been put in place to get the Hounds to where they are now. But are the Hounds, is Pittsburgh as a city in a good position to sort of take that next step with, you know, potentially some deeper pockets that, you know, could go forward and expand on the stadium and do a lot of the marketing and things like that? And do you guys see that as something that we might have to look towards in the off season, or something that maybe in our future in the offseason?
I would hope it's in the future, but I don't know if it's in this offseason. I feel like it might be still a year or two off. I feel like we definitely need to get a different culture as far as the team goes, like a winning culture, like a very, you know, it has to feel like they're in it and that they have a chance in the league before I feel like anyone's going to come in and invest money in the league or in the team itself. So if we're sitting here at the bottom of the table next year, no, it's going to be another year we have to wait. We're going to have an attractive product before people are going to put that investment into it.
Yeah, and it seems like, I don't know, I think these kind of speculative questions arise when there's not a lot of answers being put out there. I mean, so you know, this entire debate gets raised because I think there are, yeah, I don't know. I once again, I don't claim perfect knowledge, but it seems like there hasn't been a lot of quote unquote 5-year plans, you know, being pushed out the door from the Riverhounds. So yeah, who knows? I don't know.
Even if there was, though, like, let's go back to OCB, or sorry, Orange County Blues. This is like the third time they've had a rebranding and all that kind of stuff. They were the LA Blues before this, and they played in the same stadium, but it was different owners, if I remember correctly. So it's not like it's the first time, even for that team. So these teams all over the USL change hands a lot, and when they do, sometimes it's for the better and sometimes it's for the worse. Sometimes it works out, like in Orlando City, you know, that was a situation where they benefited a lot from just a 5-year plan. But other times, these owners don't stick around for 5 years. They're here for a couple of years and then they move on. So
I almost feel like owning a team is sort of one of those bucket list items that you have a lot of these wealthy bajillionaires that's just on their list. And I've read a lot of books about how owning a team is one of the worst financial decisions you can make in terms of, like, if you're expecting to get rich off of owning a team, good luck.
Yeah, it's a hobby. It's not an investment.
No. But it seemed like in the case of, you know, Orange County Blues, this is a guy who's coming in, has all this money. It's like, oh, this has been my dream to own a team. But it feels like the interest in soccer has sort of pushed the dollar value of teams higher and higher because there's more and more cities that want teams. So it's, you know, if you want to come to play, you need to bring more money to the table. And I think the only reason why I think there's a possibility that this could be us in the off season is the fact that Pittsburgh as a market for sports in general is so massive. And if there is a case where, for whatever reason, the Hounds are looking for new ownership or they're looking for help, I think the USL is more likely to step in rather than lose Pittsburgh as a potential team to something like the NASL or some other league, just to retain the market. But whether or not, Josh, to your point, whether or not that's this year or next year or 2 years down the road, I don't know. But we're just seeing this happen more often than not. And so I just thought it was interesting to think about whether or not this could be us. So, all right, I guess enough putting it off. Let's talk about the Hounds game. So the Hounds lost 4-0 to Charlotte. We are back on the bottom of the standings with 23 points. The good news is we have one game in hand on both, or we have one game in hand on Montreal. They're on 23 points. We're tied with them. And we have two games in hand on TFC2. They're on 26 points. So, Kev, you know, your whole, like, let's beat
Canada.
How
did they get
points? There's a chance.
Like, how did they get points? How did they leapfrog us?
Yeah. Yeah. So, takeaways from this game, I guess I'll start us off. You know, the first 30 minutes or so, I didn't think we looked terrible. You know, we were in there. I don't think we were the better team, but I think after the first 30 minutes, I had my notes that I thought that a draw would be a fair result at that point. And then the floodgates just sort of opened. They picked up two right before the half and then just kept going from there. The last goal coming in stoppage time at the end of the game. But,
I wanted to ask you guys' opinion on actually the starting lineup. Because when that was rolled out, I thought that was really interesting. I mean, we've put in some pretty decent performances in the past couple games with, you know, a certain group of players. And some of them were left out, mainly Okai and for Mike Green, I believe, was the swap as well as what Earl's dropping out and Alfieri slotting in. Not Alfieri, jeez.
Yeah. So the lineup that they started with was Stefan in goal, and then you had the back line of Hollingsworth, Hunt, Campbell, and Boggs. You had Maloto and Adelaide in the holding midfield position, Kerr, Herzog, and Green higher up the pitch, and then Walsh in front of them. And then on the bench, we had Alfieri, Morel, Okai, Russell, both Thompsons, and Martinez. So, So I guess the past few games, we've actually been playing Maloto in sort of that holding midfielder position. And honestly, when I first saw it, I was a bit freaked out, because I think we've talked about this, where like he doesn't really play defense. But
that's how they get their first goal. He gets dragged out to the left, and he's covering their right winger, I guess. And he doesn't do nearly enough. He stands off the guy and lets the guy get in a nice cross, and that was it.
Yeah, but I think offensively, I think that having him in that position has allowed him to flourish a little bit more than what we saw at the beginning of the season. Like, you're not putting him there to play shutdown defense. That's sort of why you have Adelaide sitting there next to him. Like, that's his job. You stay home and you just clean up in front of the center backs, and you let Maloto sort of float there and just spray balls to Kerr, Herzog, Green, and Walsh. But I didn't think he was terrible. I mean, maybe I'm just misthinking how this game played out. I don't know what you guys think.
I mean, it was all terrible, so. I don't know. It was another situation where you could just tell that morale in the game, it just, after that second goal, I thought maybe during the half that the coach could say something, or, you know, some Rudy-esque speech or something like that and get them back in the game, but no, it was really nothing. That it just seemed like they were downtrodden the rest of the time after that second goal.
When the lead-up to their first goal, I think it was their first goal, it might have been their second goal, but we gave the ball away so cheaply around our 18-yard box. We did it twice, like, back-to-back. And I don't know. I mean, there's something to be said to be able to, like, work the ball out from the back. But when you're away from home and there's under certain conditions and certain points of the game, I mean, you need to understand as a player sometimes that you just need to put your foot through it and, you know, live to fight another day kind of thing. I mean, this kind of in-game intelligence, like, you know, when you're winning the game, don't run to get the ball to make a throw in. Like, just take your time with it. Just like small things like that.
Trot.
Yeah. and so, I mean, yeah, I think they definitely kind of targeted us out wide. I mean, both the first two goals, I think, come from balls being whipped in from out wide. Maloto getting beat first. I mean, I think I like Boggs as a player, but they definitely exposed him as he's not a defending player. He's more of a midfield type slash attacker, and I think they really exposed him at right back as well.
And I don't know if that was a game plan thing or not, but I noticed there were a number of times that both Boggs and Hollingsworth were trying to carry the ball, like, through three or four people to get deeper up the pitch. And, you know, after a while, it was like, okay, like, all right, you guys can pass. It's okay. And like I said, I don't know if that was a game plan thing or not. But, yeah, Kev, to your point, I made note, like, early and often, Charlotte were just trying to get it deep to our corners and cross it in.
And I can't really blame, I mean, like, because I think Boggs put in a good performance last week. I think he's been generally playing pretty well. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad decision that he started there. I think it was just kind of an unfortunate situation. You know, I for the first two goals, I don't think Campbell or Hunt are that great either, which is, I feel like it's probably the first time I've said that all season. Yeah. They didn't have great games. Both the first two goals were just cheap goals, especially.
I mean, looking at the schedule last week when we talked about this game coming up, I don't know if any of us really expected to get a win in this game. I don't think we were expecting to get trounced 4-0. Is this a case of just better players overall? Like, we just got outplayed on the field where, you know, even if we had this shining performance like, you know, we did against Wilmington where we hang up 4 on them, do we think that still would have been enough against a team like this? Or is it more tactically, Josh, to your point, morale, just head games, and we just beat ourselves?
No, I definitely think they're the better team to begin with. But even with them being the better team, I feel like we did not show up at all. If we at least showed up for this one, I could have seen them, you know, bunkering down a little bit more, having just some possession even, and just a rougher game as far as just giving it to them. But Fortunately, it felt more like we let them just keep possession and we paid dearly for it. So I don't know. I definitely think they're a better team, though.
I think really this one kind of falls on the shoulders of the players. I think there were certain decisions made by the head coach that I wouldn't agree with, namely leaving Okai out. But at the same time, the players that he picked to start the game certainly don't merit that type of performance. They should have played a lot better, I think.
Well, and Kev, to the point about, you know, some of the tactical decisions, I noted that when the Hounds were down 3-0, it was around the 65th minute, the announcer actually said, "What's surprising to me is that neither team has made any tactical changes. Pittsburgh has made some substitutions, but no change in formation or tactics." And I think that's just something we've been dealing with all year. I mean, it's just sort of, okay, let's throw this player in. You know, in the 82nd minute, you know, we're throwing in Russell for Green, and it's like, I really like Drew Russell, but why are we using all five subs every single game? And do we really think down 3-0 that putting in Drew Russell for Mike Green is going to make is going to get us three goals to draw this? So, yeah,
at that point, it just feels like, hey, we're putting in fresh leg just to see if they can do anything. We're not putting in a person who can have a different skill set than the other person. We're just putting in fresh legs and hoping that sparks something, which isn't enough. I do think, you know, tactical changes could have been greatly appreciated in this game. And Walsh coming out, do we feel like Walsh coming out was a good idea or not? I don't personally think it was a great idea. Granted, it was like, what, the 80th minute or something like that, and we were still down zero goals, so it's not like he was performing that well.
I feel like, which, for me, it's just like, I want to get him off, like, don't look at this. Like, come over here, just don't look at this. Don't be a part of this. just come, like, cuddle in this blanket. We don't want you to be associated with this kind of thing. But, yeah.
It could also be, though, it could have been the bench itself, like Nick Thompson being like, hey, I can do something. Put me in, you know, like, something, you know what I mean? Like, it could have been something along those lines. Or just him kind of sending a message saying, like, hey, you're not performing, so you get off the field. Yeah. It could have been that.
I mean, I thought that Walsh had chances. I mean, he had a few shots that you know, the goalie had to save. They weren't, you know, amazing
spectacular shots.
But he was still getting shots. So I agree. I thought when he brought him off, and you're down 3-0, and if you think that putting in, you know, was it Nick Thompson that we subbed in for him?
I think it was Nick Thompson.
If you think that Nick Thompson is going to create a goal where Walsh didn't,
Jack Thompson. My bad.
I think the other thing
still stands.
We've mentioned this when other newer players kind of come in, and I think we were so dazzled by Walsh early on, and now we have this certain expectation of him. I mean, you know, he's still a young player, B, a new player to the team, new to the city, kind of just getting settled in. I mean, so I'm sure there's a lot going on in his head right now, both on and off the pitch. I mean, and my kind of last point on the whole substitutional lack of tactical change, be ready for this, because this is going to be like the only time I ever praise anything that like United are related to. But when Alex Ferguson was in charge of United, you know, it was, people would say, you know, if they lost a game, they would be losing a game with four strikers on the field. Like, they're not going down, not throwing everything that they have at it. And that's something that you probably want to see, you know, us do. I mean, I get it, on one hand, you put four strikers on the pitch and you leave yourself exposed to make it even more embarrassing, but I don't, that's like, that's 10% of me is worried about that. The other 90% of me wants to see some kind of aggression and some level of intent saying, no, this isn't acceptable. We're not going to not score here today. And
aggression? What?
Yeah.
No, but I agree with you, Kev. I think that what we're looking for, we know we're not making the playoffs. What we want to see at this point is some heart. Show us why, as fans, we think you should be back next year. Like, why should we cheer for you?
And look,
next
to be
year?
Four, to be fair, the past four games have been a good run.
I agree. But like, at the same time, you know, Josh, I'm not going to say speak for the whole Steel Army, but if there are players that you see over the next three games that basically just roll over and show no heart, like, how are you going to feel coming in at the beginning of next season with, you know, chance specifically for them and pulling that out?
Well, like, yeah, obviously that's terrible. And plus, it's like, if we're showing up, you should be showing up. I mean, and that's the way it feels. Like, if we're there, you know, home game in and home game out, like, the least you can do is do the same. You know what I mean? It gets frustrating when you see some players that feel like they're checked out and you're just like, well, what's the point of this?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I agree. All right, let's not dwell on this anymore. The Hounds have basically two chances to redeem themselves here before we have our next podcast. We have FC Cincinnati. They're coming to town this Wednesday, so just a few days from now, at Highmark Stadium, 7 p.m., Cincy is currently in third place. They're actually 1 point ahead of Charlotte. So I think the last time we talked, they were a few points below, but they've now worked their way up. Their last five games have been pretty legit considering where they are. So they drew 1-1 to Rochester. They lost to New York Red Bull 2-0, which we just said, they just ran away with the East. They lost 3-2 to Charlotte, but then they beat St. Louis FC 2-1, and they beat Wilmington 2-0. So it kind of feels like they got the results that they were expecting to get. So I don't know if that necessarily bodes well for us. We talked about how over these next three games, we think that we could potentially win one. So we play FC Cincinnati at home. We then travel to Bethlehem on Sunday. And then the following week, FC Cincinnati comes back and we play them for our final home game. And I think we had said that we thought that we could probably pick up a win against FC Cincinnati in one of those two games, and a draw potentially at Bethlehem. Bethlehem's pretty much out of it as well. They need some help from OCB to make the playoffs. Do we still feel that way, or do you guys not care at this point? Or what? I mean, but I'm being somewhat honest. Like, what is your demeanor about this next game?
I mean,
on
immediately,
Wednesday?
Like, when we're about to start the podcast, in my head, I'm just thinking, like, I don't know if I have the energy to talk about another 4-0 loss. Like, we're gonna have to right now, and that's just kind of what it feels like the season has been. I don't know if I have the energy anymore to just, you know, not to worry about this stuff, but it's, you know, it takes a toll on fans. Obviously, it takes a toll on the players and the coaching staff and everything like that. So as far as, yeah, you said, like, do we not care? Look, I don't want to see us. To Josh's point, you know, I want to see players play like they still care and they still want to, you know, put on a performance for the fans and for the other 10 men out on that pitch with them. That's what I'm concerned with. Frankly, I don't. If we win all three of these games or if we lose all three of these games, obviously I'll be more happy with the win, but it's a different kind of, I don't know, it's a different kind of situation than it would be like mid or early season, because obviously there's nothing really to push for at this point.
I feel like it's a home game. You're in front of your fans. You only have two home games left.
Yeah.
You got to show up and you got to get that win. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Now, it's going to be hard, though. It's a Wednesday game. It's supposed to be a rainy day. So, you know, another Hounds home game that's going to be full of rain. Big surprise there. And it's going to be hard because they're playing three games in 1 week, essentially. So that's rough. I wouldn't be surprised if this is the game where we tie instead of win. But you got to feel like they're going for the win the whole time. Like, I don't want to see a team who's just kind of, like, trying out new tactics and, like, you know, we're playing this like a scrimmage. Like, it has to be a real game. Because at this point, you know, you need to make up some face in front of the home crowd. Every game is an opportunity to do that, so.
Yeah, I agree. So the Cincy, you know, typically we talk about top players and all of that. I think at this point it's not that big of a deal. But the one player that, you know, everyone will probably remember is Sean Acoli. He has 15 goals, three more than Herzog currently has. So that sort of tells you where he's at. He is their go-to guy. They try to feed him the ball early and often. So look for somebody like Campbell to be knocking him around, probably picking up some fouls outside the area.
Is he the guy with the blonde hair who looks like he's 16 or something?
No.
He scored last time, the guy who I'm talking about. I forget his name.
No, that's not Sean Acoli. I can't remember that guy's name. I'll have to look it up. But we played them twice over, you know, this 10-day span, both at home. So we'll sort of see how that shakes out. And then Sunday we have Sunday at 3 p.m. we'll be in Bethlehem against the Steel. And like I mentioned, Bethlehem haven't been mathematically eliminated from the playoffs, but they're pretty close. They need to win. They only have two games left. They need to win the remaining two games, including the one against us, and get a ton of help from OCB and Wilmington to crack the top eight. So they're likely going to come to play just because they don't know what's going to happen there, even though the odds probably aren't in their favor.
Just naturally, I'm getting much more excited for that game because it feels like it's, once again, it's another PA battle. And I don't know. I feel... It honestly might be something where, you know, earlier in the season, we've heard all the noise about Cincy wanting to make the push for the MLS, them packing the stadium, all this other stuff. Just the rhetoric around them, they feel... This is going to sound, like, depressing, but they almost feel like they're in another league than what we currently are. Not just results, but also the kind of just, you know, everything that's kind of happening around them. So... When I think about us playing Cincy, I'm like, ugh, like, you know, it's hard for me to get excited about that. With the Bethlehem game, you know, that'll be an easy team talk. You know what I mean? Like, just go out there and make sure that our interstate rivals don't get one over on us. And just naturally as a fan, I think that's one that I'm definitely looking forward to more.
Cincy feels like we could be like a spoiler, like, you know what I mean? Like, if we win a Cincy game, it feels like, you know, haha on you, we beat you. Whereas Bethlehem Steel feels like an actual competition where it's just like, hey, this is a game and we're, you know, in-state rivals or could be, hopefully, you know, if they stick around and if it shows up. But I think both games have an appeal because, you know, Ohio State and Pittsburgh or any Ohio team in Pittsburgh kind of have that rivalry going on, but you're right, they do feel like they're almost on another level as far as just the money going into the club compared to ours, which is even more of a reason for me at least to like really want to see a win against them.
It's hard coming off of a 4-0 loss. It's like, ah, oh, jeez, like, that's true. Couldn't we play them like before we had this result? And I think in that sense then I'd be much more on your wavelength as far as like, yeah, we could totally spoil their party. Now I'm just feeling a little more pessimistic about that.
So here's the question, guys. We are currently in last place in the East. We're not last place overall. There's a team in the West that has less points than we do. We are last place in the East, and we have these three games left, two against FC Cincy and one against Bethlehem. We are tied with Montreal, who have New York Red Bulls 2 and Harrisburg to play. Do we finish above Montreal when this is all said and done?
I'm going to say yes.
Yeah, I think so too.
So you think, I'm going to go ahead and say that Montreal loses to Red Bull too, unless they just completely phone it in and just like, we won it, it's done. So I think Montreal against Harrisburg, that's anywhere from 1 to 3 points. So we're saying over the next three games, we pick up 3 to 4 points. We think that's realistic.
I'm saying, I think so. Yeah, I'm saying we pick up three and, I don't think they beat Harrisburg, but
so here's the other question. Keeping in with the Canada theme, TFC 2 only has one game left, and it's against Rochester, and they currently have 3 more points than we do. So, do we think that TFC 2 beats Rochester?
No.
And if not,
who's home? Who's home? Kevin, who's away?
No. Let me see here. So they are at Rochester.
Yeah, they don't beat Rochester.
What's the tiebreaker? Okay, so if we end up level on points, is it goal differential?
Yeah, it might be head to head and then goal differential. I don't know.
I think the managers have to have a fist fight.
Isn't that how we were going to settle the Keystone Derby?
I'm back in Brandt for that one. I got to be honest.
That's what I'm saying.
All that time at Navy. Yeah. All right, so we're predicting.
We think, like, if you walk through the doors of Navy, you're just, like, this hard, like.
Automatically. You know? Just boom. That's all it takes.
Going to Navy.
Yeah. So, all right, so we're saying, you know, we still got three games left. We think we're going to pick up anywhere from 3 to 4 points, and that's going to be enough to get us to at least third from the bottom of the East, above the two Canada teams that Kevin has been pulling for all season. Definitely.
Okay, if that's all I have to look forward to this season. Oh, fine, that's all. That's I'll take it.
Great. Yeah,
Canada.
Something.
Something. All right. Well, I don't think we really have anything else for this show. I think it's coming in a little bit shorter than usual, but then again, we're not going to spend a ton of time talking about a 4-0
so
loss,
are the River
or at least
Hounds.
More than we already did.
So. I'm kidding. I have to. It was set up perfectly.
All right. Well, okay, guys, then let's wrap this one up. For Kevin, Josh, I am Mike. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks for sticking with us all season. We know that, Josh, you said it early on. This was not the best season to start a podcast. But, you know, the fact that everyone keeps listening and keeps contributing and sharing stuff online, it's fantastic. You know, here's to, you know, a great final three games. Here's to a great offseason. Here's to a great, you know, future with the team. So thanks again, everybody. And, yeah, we'll talk to you very, very soon.
Cheers.
Later.